Hey everybody, sci-fi and comic book fans. This is me, last I checked, Tony Todd, also the Klingon Kern from Star Trek, the voice of Lego Darkseid, and Zoom, the fastest man alive. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello out there to all of you listeners. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Things are going to take a sinister turn today as I welcome my special guest. He's really a nice guy. He just plays some intense characters on screen. He is an incredible actor. You've seen him in horror flicks, sci-fi, and superhero shows. And you've heard him as the voice of a bunch of our favorite characters. The one and only Tony Todd is going to be joining me today on the show. Now, you regular listeners of Comic Book Central, you might remember back on episode 142, I met up with Tony Todd last summer in Connecticut. It was at Terrificon. We did a quick Facebook Live there. You can catch that on the Comic Book Central Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network, or you can click the Facebook link on the website, comicbookcentral.net. I played that audio of the Facebook Live right here on the show, and at the time, Tony mentioned that he was looking forward to sitting down for an in-depth chat. We finally got the scheduling worked out. Tony is here today. He's going to be joining us in just a moment. Man, going to be another groovy time here in the lair. So glad you're all out there hanging out with us today here in the Comic Book Central lair. It's going to be a good one. Now, I mentioned Terrificon. Once again, I'm going to be taking the show on the road to Connecticut to record some content for all of you listeners out there. I'm going to be moderating some Q&As, just like I've done the past few years. Always have a fun time there. It's August 18th through the 20th. Now, all the information you need can be found at the website, terrificon.com. Don't worry about writing anything down. I'm going to put a link in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net, so you'll have that there. For Terrificon, man, as always, very cool guest list shaping up. From Guardians of the Galaxy Volumes 1 and 2, friend of Comic Book Central, Sean Gunn, makes a triumphant return to Terrificon. He's going to be there again this year. Now, you can hear my brief interview with Sean on episode 142 as well. Caught up with him there. Also, an in-depth chat on episode 152 with Sean Gunn. So you can check those out as well. Also appearing at Terrificon this year, from, again, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, he plays Taserface.
Your name is Taserface?
It's metaphorical!
Now, this talented gentleman, he is also on a television show near the top of the DVR queue in the Stuber household from NBC's This Is Us, Chris Sullivan. He's going to be a guest at Terrificon this year. Also, the dynamic duo. The original dynamic duo making their final Connecticut appearance together, Adam West and Burt Ward. They're going to be there, joined by a friend of Comic Book Central and my match game partner twice here on the show, Catwoman herself, Lee Merriweather. They're all going to be there, plus the Bat vehicles, the Batmobile, Batcopter, Batboat, and Batcycle. They're all going to be there. More talented folks that you've heard right here in Comic Book Central. They're going to be at Terrificon. Superman, Dean Cain, Jesse Quick from The Flash, Violet Bean. She's going to be there as well. Plus, man, this guest list, Jessica Henwick from Iron Fist and Star Wars The Force Awakens, and from Gotham, Benedict Samuel. They're all going to be there. Comic book creators. Man, there's so many comic book creators. Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Ordway, Roy Thomas, Howard Chaykin. Some of those names seem familiar. They've appeared right here in Comic Book Central as well. Dozens more are going to be there. More to be announced in the weeks ahead. Again, terrificon.com. That's where you find out what you need to know, and that's how you can get your tickets. Again, I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes for this episode of my website. I'm telling you what, my buddy Mitch Halleck, he puts on a terrific show. Yes, it is. It's aptly named. Bigger and better each and every year. So get your tickets now. Like I mentioned, Tony was a guest last year at Terrificon. He is my guest in the Comic Book Central lair today. Take a listen to this, and then I will zoom right back here with the great Tony Todd. Tony grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. He discovered a love for acting in high school and went on to study theater at the Eugene O'Neill National Actors Theater Institute and Trinity Rep Conservatory. Numerous stage plays followed, which eventually led to on-screen roles in such high-profile flicks as Platoon, Colors, and Lean on Me, as well as guest spots on television hits Simon and Simon, 21 Jump Street, MacGyver, so many others. In 1990, he landed his first leading role in the remake of the horror classic Night of the Living Dead, and that ushered in a multitude of incredibly diverse stage, film, and television roles in just about every genre you can name. He terrified moviegoers as Candyman in the original film and numerous sequels. He beamed on board the Starship Enterprise as Worf's brother Kern on Star Trek The Next Generation.
This is not a Klingon ship, sir.
No, Commander, it is not. If it were a Klingon ship, I would have killed you for offering your suggestion.
And he continued Kern's trek onto Deep Space Nine, where he also appeared as an older version of Sir Rock Lofton's character, Jake Sisko, in one of the greatest and most heartbreaking Trek episodes of all time. Smallville, X-Files, 24, Chuck, the Final Destination series. And over the years, Tony has built one of the most expansive resumes in Hollywood, which includes voicing some of the most iconic roles in pop culture history for animated series and video games. Darkseid, Icon, Blade, and in season 2 of the CW hit series, The Flash, he was the voice of the evil speedster Zoom.
Never forget, I am the fastest man alive.
Well, joining me now is an incredibly versatile actor who's appeared in just about every genre of movie and TV show you can name. He's played everything from Candyman to Klingon, and he recently gave us the willies as the voice of the supervillain Zoom on The Flash. A super welcome to one of the hardest working men in showbiz, Tony Todd. Tony, welcome back to Comic Book Central.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be back here, Joe. Thank you very much for having patience with me and sorting through the schedule, but here we are.
Oh, please, are you kidding? We get to talk to Tony Todd. We get to talk to every character that Tony Todd's ever played. There's a whole lot.
All in one voice.
All in one. Oh, my goodness. Well, look, I got the chance to meet you and chat briefly with you at Trivicon. I got to record your first Facebook Live, so thank you for allowing me the honor to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Busy guy, man. I'm looking at your IMDb page. You got like at least 12 projects in various phases of production. That's insane work.
You know, the thing with IMDb, until the deal is done, you never know what's being said. Although my manager, Jeff, who I know you've had correspondence with, is very careful about constantly checking that, because sometimes people can drop things and
okay.
You know, so we're always cleaning it up.
Okay, so well, but you are
today,
a busy guy.
I hope there's 12 real ones.
That's true. Hope there's 12 checks behind them, right?
Yeah, well, the check is the last thing you get. I care about the integrity of the truth first and foremost.
There you go. Well, I mean, we're looking at these things. I mean, I know from a fact. I mean, I've talked to you, and I know your schedule, and you're bouncing all over the place. You're doing theater. You're doing TV. Where in the world do you find the time to do all these things?
You have no idea. I think we have, what, 4 different couches in this house? And they all have a little imprint on my butt. Listen, I'm a hardworking man, but when I'm not working, I can be one of the laziest SOBs in the world. All I care about is I cook, I make sure my cats are happy, do a little gardening, and then I spend a lot of time on a couch or a nice comfy chair or in a hammock or a swing. That's what we do.
What do you make when you're cooking? What do you make when you're cooking? What's your specialty?
What did I do last night? I did a little nice, got a nice cut of filet mignon, did a little sear in a cast iron skillet, popped it in the oven, a little garlic, onion, mushroom infusion on top of it, some Italian squash, and a little balsamic rice.
Nice. Now you got me hungry.
I'm sorry, man. But we were just before the show, we were talking about Memphis barbecues.
Yeah, we were.
Because now, as I told my lady just recently, I said I've been craving red meat almost. I tried to we go from fish, beef, and chicken, but I've been all week long, it's been a red meat thing. What's going on?
All right, well, I got you hungry for Memphis barbecue.
Your body
you got
always
me hungry
talks
for years.
To you, right?
I know, we're even now. Hey, look, I mentioned we met up at Trivicon in Connecticut. That's close to home for you, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut,
okay.
Which I have fond memories of. You know, my single woman, my aunt, rescued me at age 3, raised me. Made sure I was in a different program every single summer to just keep my mind active and my hands off of negative things. and it worked, apparently.
Okay,
and,
she kept you in line.
She did. I mean, I was a Boy Scout for, it was a Life Scout, two badges, merit badges shy of Eagle. It was, but it was a defining period of my life because it gave me focus, the ability to finish a task, you know, and I was rewarded. But my first airplane trip ever was to Tokyo, Japan, on a World Jamboree, which was insane.
So that opened up a lot of worlds to you. What kind of kid were you?
Yeah.
What kind of things did you dig on? Did you? I mean, you're known for like these horror films and supervillains and Klingon. I mean, did that stuff appeal
totally
to you as a kid?
That.
Or?
Well, I loved movies, and my aunt and I used to watch the 8 o'clock movie every single night. And you know, those days it was you didn't have the choices that we have now, so they tended to only put on good movies. So we watched all the classics, which ran the gamut from great drama. You know, a lot of John Garfield movies, a lot of William Holden, and the Universal monster movies with the classics.
Nice.
And then she would always, we'd finish, and then she'd give me a little morality lesson. We watch White Heat, James Cagney is standing on top, and Top of the World, Ma. I said, would you want to make that decision? Absolutely not, but it was fun to watch, that kind of thing. And then I had to do a lot of shuttling. I was a key latch kid, so I had to spend time between my grandmother and her. And fortunately, on the bus route, was always, those days, they always had a comic kiosk near every bus stop. And I spent, so I knew these comic guys by name, you know, the guys that sold the books themselves.
Okay.
So I'd save up my little pennies and get my 25-cent, 80-page giant comics. And those were probably my earliest scripts.
Okay.
Because as any kid that was really into the bold artwork that came from the book, you know, you try to put your own voice to what was going on. And that amused me for many, 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 many months.
Well, I knew you. Your comic book cred is definitely secure, because I know even at the show, you made a point to get Green Lantern 86 signed by Neil Adams, who was right outside.
You remember that? That's
I do. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were like stoked
about that.
And
you know what? And Neil, I was so stoked. And recently I saw him about less than a year ago, and he gave me, remember that big giant comic of Muhammad Ali versus Superman?
Oh, what did you get?
He gave me one of those prints and signed it again to one of my biggest fans, and I have it framed. I have this little hallway that's my hallway of infamy. You don't want to walk down there with a black light, trust me.
Does this lead to your man cave?
Part of the end, I leave. Well, no, I do. I gave up a man cave in the spot. I was going to do something in the garage. Every area of the house, it belongs to all of us. So,
what drew you to that comic book, that Green Lantern 86? Because this was the anti-drug comic book. This was like comics took a real adult turn at this point, a real landmark moment.
Really fantastic. That whole series of holding him in his arms, Speedy in his arms and stuff. It was fantastic.
What drew you to those types of books? Were you a DC guy?
I was always a DC guy. Mm. Although, you know, before, I mean, when Chris Claremont came around and revitalized X-Men, I was into that. And I was into a lot of the Steve Ditko, Jack Kirby drawn stuff, you know. But DC always, to me, it seemed to me that Marvel talked about world stuff, and DC, to me, felt human, more human.
Mm.
You know,
interesting.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, Marvel seemed to me broader and more interplanetary conflicts, and the DC characters dealt with problems in the cities and stuff.
Yeah, especially those issues that we were talking about with Green Lantern and Green Arrow too. So, did you see? Because you mentioned you were raised by your aunt, kind of going back and forth. Were comic books like an escape for you as a child?
Not an escape. They were like an essential item in my backpack. I mean, it wasn't something. It went right there with the lunchbox.
Okay.
Went right there with the school books.
Okay.
The yo-yo, my top, you know, my playing top. For those that don't know what that is, you know, it's a little instrument. You wind a string around, you put it on the ground, and it spins, kids. Those are the things I had. And I was also I started studying magic at a fairly early age, around 12, 13. And I'm still an amateur magician to this day.
Okay.
So I have friends, there's a place out here in L.A. called the Magic Castle, which is just fantastic. If you ever get a chance to visit there, do it. It's a big mansion. Every single room is dedicated to a different type of magic. There's one bar called the Artemis Bar, where they have this owl. An owl represents, among magicians, is one of the little, you know, representations. Anyway, you ask a yes or no question, and Artemis answers it correctly, whether he knows you or not.
Okay.
That's just one thing. And then in the basement is the W.C. Fields room. He was also a practicing magician. It's just a great place.
Who was Mr. Fairchild at Hartford High?
He was a biology teacher who, on the side, was the head of the drama program. And I did a lot of my formulative work from junior and senior with him. I think he cast me in about 5 shows in a 2-year period. And it was kind of my high school finishing period. Great guy. I didn't particularly care for biology, so it was interesting that he actually put me out of his class in biology because he thought I was going to fail and he couldn't handle, you're good at this, but you can't do this. But when it came to drama, he really encouraged me. Between him and my scoutmaster, Mr. Johnson, Sandy Johnson and Fairchild, and another English teacher, Mrs. Reynolds, who gave me a copy of The Tempest when I had a growth spurt and was just totally useless to the athletic department. And that was like, for me, it was before graphic comic books came out, but it was, to me, it was like a giant graphic comic book come to life. Now, this has been after, you know, years spending trying to get all the Batman exclamations down and Green Lantern's Mighty Oath down, you know, it just made common sense. And that really put me on the path to seriously taking theater as a career option.
Okay, so you could even see like a connection between comic books and theater with all, especially like some of the Stan Lee dialogue too. I mean, it was so like Shakespearean and like, you know, all these larger than life.
Still Shakespearean, but yes, yes. Yeah. High reaching, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, talking to the people in the back row, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, look, you've been involved in a lot of projects that were larger, you know, larger-than-life situations, many times playing larger-than-life characters. As an actor, when you're getting into these different roles, do you have a certain approach to each project to sort of find, even though these characters are, like, way out, do you have an approach as an actor where you try to find the realism of the character?
You have to. You have to, and it has to be grounded in your own personal life experiences. So I've had, you know, after the high school thing, I had a great my first college, I went to University of Connecticut. I actually dropped out, but I loved the theater department so much, I hung around campus unofficially for about almost 2 years. And then I got serious and went to the Jim O'Neill Theater Center and then to Trinity Rep, got my master's. But it's, you know, all characters have to be grounded in your life experience. And fortunately, I've had a lot of a lot of my uncles and cousins were homicide detectives in New York, and they used to make 4 trips a year from New York to Little Hartford just to, you know, keep the family intact. And it was important for me because they were my father figures. And so I got a lot of realism at the dinner table with those guys, but also a tremendous amount of love and tough love. And, you know, every child needs that. And then my life experience, you know, I've been involved in politics all my life. I did a lot of participate. I remember one of the first times I ever went to Ohio. I was on a bus from Connecticut to travel to Cleveland as part of the Kent State protest movement. So, you know, the more things you do, the more things you know, whether people agree with them or not, the stronger your convictions become and the more life experience you have so that you can have a reasonable discussion with people in a bar or a boardroom.
So you can bring a little bit of that to each role, too. I mean, yeah. So
seeing Tokyo, Japan, and all that neon light when you're 13, 12, from that sets a template for how I'm an adventurer. I love, so besides sitting on the couches, whenever I get a chance to travel, we travel, you know?
Yeah.
And that's when I'm really the most active. I get to walk around, you know, spent Christmas in Rome 2 years ago, which was, you have to experience that. It's unbelievable. If you like to eat, they believe in 3-4-hour meals at a time.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah, that's, well, yeah, we had some friends from Italy that came over, and yeah, we had dinner, and it was an evening. It was an entire evening.
Yeah.
It was fun. So, hey, look,
another bottle of wine.
Oh, man, it was, see, now I'm getting really hungry before we do this. Hey, look, before we get to two of our favorites, Star Trek and The Flash, I want to take a few quick takes on some of your noteworthy genre roles. Full disclosure, most horror films are outside my wheelhouse, but I will say, when I've mentioned your name to a lot of fellow nerds, they go berserk and they yell out, Candyman. They just scream. Wow. One even said, okay, Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers, Candyman right there with him. So there, I guess if there were like a Mount Rushmore of horror, I guess Candyman would be on the top there.
Who wouldn't want that? Of all the roles I've done, I don't know if I would want to single anyone out. They're all like children, you know?
Yeah.
But I appreciate Bernard Rose, who wrote and adapted Candyman from the Clive Barker source, The Book of the Forbidden, is a dear friend. And, you know, he told me when we were shooting, he says, you know, this is going to be an indelible one. And I said, well, I don't know about that. Let's just do the job. And then years later, it started to bother me a little bit because constantly people would come up to me and say, you know, you scared the bejesus out of me when I was a kid. I didn't know we were making a children's movie. It was a movie for adults.
Yeah, I think the warning's clearly on the package, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody went to Blockbuster and Hollywood Video. They were all up and down Columbus. But anyway, I went to Bernard and I said, well, what is the deal with this? He says, Tony, anybody that remembers a film when they're young is going to remember it for the rest of their lives. So you should just embrace it, accept it, and keep working. And that's what I try to do.
Well, I did, like I mentioned, a little bit outside my wheelhouse. I have drafted the help of some listeners for some of these questions, too. Well, listener Brian Latendra, he's from the Secret Identity podcast. He wants to know where you see Candyman in relation to these other horror icons we mentioned, Michael Myers, Jason, Freddy.
A lot of those actors are friends of mine. And, you know, I'm happy to be part of the memorable group of horror because, unfortunately, in horror films, there's a lot of bad horror, and I'm glad that we got out of the torture porn method of horror filmmaking. And so he's an iconic character. I accept that, and I know he's important to a lot of different groups of people, which is impressive. Like, I have a lot of Southern horror fans who love him. One time I was at a con, I don't know where, but this group of people came up to me and they looked like they were right out of The Hills Have Eyes. But they came up to my table with unadulterated love and said, we do love your films. And we love the way you kill people. And then I get the same reaction from gang members in East St. Louis who say, man, you know, Candyman is a legend up here in these halls. So,
you never know how to take that, right?
I just listen. That's all I can do because by that point, Candyman is 25 years old. I've done so many other things, but I never forget a single job, even the ones that didn't work.
One of the most memorable scenes in the movie, you know, the bees in your mouth and on your face. There, 1992, not a whole lot of CGI going on back in 92, right? You did that for real? Like those were real bees?
That was a physical, practical.
Why did you do that?
Because I'm fearless. I mean, I was trained as an actor to be fearless. That you can never
stunt guy.
Until you go right to the source, and that was it. And when I read that, I knew that I didn't know how Candyman was going to receive, but I knew that would be indelible, and that image would last forever.
Okay, but you had something like a. Was there like a prosthetic?
I had a dental dam. There was a prosthetic, but still, we had a bee wrangler on set. There was over almost a million bees on our set in their own little trailer. So when it came time to getting ready to make the scene work, I'm the first one on the set because I had to be loaded up and stuff, and then the crew would come in, and then Bernard would be behind the monitor calling action. So
you took some hits?
Yeah, I got, I think, over the three films, maybe 26 stings.
That's painful to even hear.
But this has been quoted, and because I had a great lawyer at the time, so we got compensated for each one of those. So, you know.
Good for you. Yeah, get it in writing, right? Yeah, if you're going to shove bees
in
your mouth, get it in
Hollywood,
writing.
You better have it in writing.
Oh, man. Another movie based on a comic book series, The Crow, 1994. What can you tell us about your experience working on the film, working with Brandon Lee, and how Hollywood even sort of changed after the tragic incident on the film?
Well, it changed forever. It definitely changed forever. First of all, I was proud to be working with Alex Boyas, who directed and was a big part of the production design. James O'Barr is a good friend of mine, another great comic book writer and illustrator. And David Scow, who did the adaptation. So that was a heady time for me. The 90s is when I did the most concentrated period of my work. It seemed like the phone was always ringing, which is probably why every chance I get to be on the couch now, I take it. But it wasn't, I mean, seriously, every week would go by, there was another job. So I was riding a high streak. We shot in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is a fantastic little portside city. And the cast is great. Ernie Hudson's a good friend of mine. Bai Ling, and Brandon, rest in peace, was a very full of life gentleman. He was there with his fiancée, who was there on his side, by his side the entire time. And that's probably the most tragic of everything, because I don't think she'll ever be the same. You know, when the incident happened, unfortunately, there was no rules, labor rules at that time. And so we were working 17 hours a day and in a highly action, highly toxic, you know, situations. And unfortunately, when Brandon met his demise, you know, there was a couple safety checks that somehow missed the scrutiny. So he'll be missed, and the crow is one of the constant things on my table at conventions. People, I can't think of a convention where people haven't purchased a crow signature.
And they even changed things after. I mean, just the working hours too.
Yeah, they had to change. They changed the laws. I think now it's the limit is 15.
Yeah, just to avoid the exhaustion.
They have to swap out some of the crew guys. Is you know, actors have it easy. We have trailers. We have, you know, snacks available to us. We have craft services constantly. But it's the crew that is on the set, on their feet, most of the time. You know, from usually an hour before actors even show up to an hour afterwards. So, and there was another incident that happened out here in Hollywood where a crew member lost his life driving home from a set. And I forget his name, but they created a law saying that, you know, crew members, union crew members, couldn't work past 13 hours a day.
Wow. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Sometimes you just get in the middle of these productions.
I'm a union guy, so, you know, a lot of people come to me and say, hey, man, could you be in my film? Could you do something? They say, you know, first of all, you can't ask me. You got to ask my manager, and then it's got to be union.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to give the roles.
Well, SAG has been good to me. They have a great health plan. I feel bad for what's going on with the health situation in America, but we have a solid dental health. Full, you know, even if you need some psychiatric investments, you can do it. But who needs that? Who cares about that? All you need to do is go to a comic book store, pick up Green Lantern, The Flash, and Batman, and you'll work it out.
That's the thing. You get to go into these other worlds and everything works out.
You know what I bought yesterday? You know what I got yesterday? I got, I'm a huge gamer, so I got Injustice 2.
Oh, no. Okay. So you're not only on the couch, you're playing games on the couch.
Oh, yeah. I spent about 3 hours of it last night. Have you seen it or played it
yet? I have not. No, but now.
It is in the drawings. I mean, it's insane. You got every single hero and villain in the DC universe.
Is Darkseid in there?
Darkseid is in there.
But Tony Todd's not in this one.
No, you know, I was listening to him last night. Yeah, I think it's my brother. I think I'm not absolutely sure on this, but it sounded a lot like Michael Dorn.
Wow. Oh, okay. I'll have to check that out.
Confirm that.
Your Star Trek brother.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
yeah.
Before we get to Star Trek, I wanted to ask you about another comic book project. One of my favorite episodes of Smallville. Jitters, mm-hmm. as Earl Jenkins. Man, I feel sorry for Earl Jenkins. He's not a villain.
Earl, man. He wasn't. And what was also weird about that filming that episode, that we were filming during 9/11. So we're up in Vancouver, and what was supposed to be a 10-day shoot, once 9/11 happened, everything shut down, we couldn't get out. And it ended up being like almost a month of shooting for that episode.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because I tried to go into Canada a few months after that, and it was just very difficult.
It was crazy. I remember the night it happened, everybody was just gathered around, you know, the HMV music store watching the monitors. It was unbelievable. But we survived. And so I think a part of that, the tension of that time went into what was going on there. I was just happy. I got to do that, and I got to work with Chris Reeve before he passed also. So got to work with two Supermen in my life.
Oh, wow.
Which is great.
That's
But Earl was definitely a tragic character that was affected by kryptonite poisoning.
That final scene with yourself and Tom Welling and Michael Rosenbaum and that, just sort of walk us through a little bit about that, because it's, I mean, it looks amazing. The set,
on
I mean,
the
I know
bridge,
there's a lot of, yeah,
stuff,
I know there's
yeah.
a lot of CGI and things like that, but I mean, it,
no,
overall, the set looks amazing. Oh, really? So, that, I mean,
it
that was like a full set?
Yeah, it was. Vancouver is one of the, you know, strongest filmmaking cities in the world. I mean, you know, they're affectionately referred to as Hollywood North. They have great crews up there. When last year, when I was working on Dead of Summer for Ian Goldberg, who's now doing Krypton series, which hopefully I'll be a part of at some point. Shout out, Ian, pick up the phone. they have, like, when we did Dead of Summer, we had a crew of 100 for a TV series on Freeform. I mean, I couldn't even tell. I stopped trying to know who everybody was, because it's like, what do you do? Okay, I'm part of the trucking crew. I got it. Okay, and what do you do? Oh, there's 3 craft services trucks. Got it. You know, what do? I carry the cables, man, through the woods. What do you want from me? So because of that, and because they've embraced and they give tremendous tax cuts to American-based film companies, they've got these great facilities up there. I think, you know, X-Files is one of the first shows that really solidified it. Mm-hmm. MacGyver, Stargate, you know, those are the ones that have lasted for a long time. So they know what they're doing, and they have great location scouts, and they find these tremendous backgrounds that are almost like the backgrounds you see drawn in comic books. So it was perfect. But
yeah,
that bridge that we're on was a real
bridge. That was amazing. Oh, okay. So did you get to go on that at all, or is that all stunt?
Oh, yeah. I was bad, dude. How many people can double me? I'm 6'5".
That's a good point.
I had suspension wires on me. Look, if the person that was with me that I'm with now was with me there, I probably wouldn't have done it, but I did it. I was, again, it's going to be fearless, and I didn't, I consider it a blessing to be working, because so many people want to be actors. The school I went to, which was a master's program, there's 24 of us in the graduating. There's only 3 of us that work today. And a lot of them, you know, life happens. People get married, kids happen. And unfortunately, for all the young actors out there, a lot of people, you know, there are 3 cities you have to go through, Chicago, New York, or L.A. And a lot of people, it's tough if you have never been in a big city, if you don't have that inner fortitude, if you don't have a support system, family back home, that not necessarily to call to ask for money, but just to call and ask for love. You have to have that, because there's a lot of rejection in this business. If you look at my IMDb page, you see over almost 200 credits. Mm-hmm. But for every credit I have, there's 10 roles that I didn't get. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones I also remember. Kind of jumped all over the place, but I'm getting back to the fact that the bridge is outstanding. And whenever I'm asked to be on set, I'm happy to be there.
It looks amazing. It looks amazing. Yeah. I love that scene. It is so intense. It looks amazing. Well, one of your credits that we definitely want to get to, Star Trek. 30th anniversary Star Trek Next Generation. What was your process coming into Star Trek? And because you had tried out for a few times on like different roles, right?
Five times. I'll never forget it. 5 times. So by the 3rd time, and these were consecutive, pretty fairly within 5 times within 2 months. So I knew that they were interested. They were just, and you know, that whole staff is very meticulous. So they were waiting for the right role, and I think I hit the jackpot with being fortunate to be Michael Dorn's brother Kern to his Worf. So that was another show that me and my aunt used to watch. So the very first scene I shot was on board the Enterprise. So all kinds of memories are flooding through my mind and stepping on board, but then, okay, forget about the fanboy stuff. You're here to do your professional job. And, the first line I said was Mr. Wesley Crusher.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, too, was that, like, it's one thing to have rehearsals. It's one thing to go to get the gig and you get the script and go. But once you're in full Klingon makeup and you walk onto the Enterprise or you're beamed onto the Enterprise in the transporter room there, what does that do for your performance as an actor of just now it's not just a script in your hand at this point?
No, you have to be that person. It certainly helped with the Klingon, because like when I got that job. I was walking on the Marx Brothers building. I'm almost in the street thinking, oh, there's another one that got away. Casting director runs out and says, Tony, you got it. He was a huge fan. He says, you got to report the wardrobe. So I run over to the another building on the Paramount set, and I swear to you, you open the door, and it was like, I don't know, a football-filled size of all Klingon gear, boots, you know, chest plates, pants. It was like insane. I said, you guys can't fit me. He said, yeah, we can. And they gave me the stuff. So you put on, you know, you put on the clothes. I'm the type of actor that, like, you use everything you can to transform. So, like, with the Beavis and Candyman, that helped me get in that mood. You put on these massive boots, you put on these clothes, and then you report the makeup, and it's a four-hour process. So if you're a trained actor, you don't fight that. You allow that to help you with the transformation. And so by the time I got on set, I wasn't intimidated, and I knew who, you know, that dinner scene that we have in the very first one was incredible. I mean, their prop department, it was real stuff, and, you know, they have a schedule, so we shot it in time.
You grabbed the big turkey leg and slapped it.
Yeah, big turkey
leg. Slapping the caviar around.
Get that. Yeah, I'm going to get that.
Did you have a chat with Michael Dorn? You mentioned your TV brother, Michael Dorn. Did you have a chat with him ahead of time and, like, talk, like, how to get in the mind of a Klingon? Because he had been doing this for a while. Nothing like that?
Yeah, he had established a template. So small secret. I think he was fighting for his cousin to get the role, if I recall. He did reveal that to me, but it was fine. And, I'm trained moment to moment. So whatever he gives me, I'm going to give him back, you know. So that part was easy, and we've become friends, good friends since then.
Yeah, the two-part Redemption followed up Sins of the Father. While Redemption was being filmed, great two-parter. Ronald Reagan was on set?
Not on the day I was there.
Okay, because I know Patrick Stewart had talked about that, where he just kind of like walked up and said. Okay, so you didn't get to meet Reagan.
I did not.
Okay, that's just because it was such a crazy time, too, because it was like Star Trek VI was in the theaters, and it was like sort of an allusion to the end of the Cold War, and then as the Cold War was ending, and really, so I didn't know if you had a part of that.
I always knew that the NASA people and people that worked in, you know, space engineering and stuff were huge fans.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of stuff.
Sins of the Father, always mentioned in the top 10 for Next Gen. Deep Space Nine, not only did you get to bring the character of Kern back again, but, my goodness, The Visitor. One of our listeners had a question. Yeah, listener Dan Scranton, what episode of Star Trek, of any of the series, because you've been on three of the series, do you feel was your best work? I'm going to guess that this is probably the answer to that question.
If you make me list them. But again, roles are like children, so I don't want anybody to feel bad because I appreciated being part of the Star Trek legacy. You know, it was Star Trek that introduced me to the whole con world, convention world. I remember the first one I ever attended was in Vermont. It was like $3 to get in and $5 the signature. My, have things have changed. But The Visitor, you know, again, everything starts with how I was raised. So my aunt, who had raised me, had passed away. And so she, you know, she had gotten to see that I was going to be okay and that I was working steadily. I actually flew her on a plane. She had never been on a plane before, up to Calgary. I was shooting Black Fox, a Western I did with Christopher Reeve. And so for 2 weeks, she's sitting on the sidelines watching her baby boy, you know, drive stagecoaches. But so she had passed, and I was really depressed and just inconsolable because to this day, I still remember her phone number. And out of the blue, that script came, and it was like a sign. It was like she was telling me, get up. I know you love me, and channel me. Use me as inspiration for the rest of your life and your work and your heart, and that's what I tried to do. But I'm really proud that Hollywood Reporter made a list of the top 100 episodes of all the series all time, and The Visitor came in number 13. So
wow.
That to me is the best thing out of the whole experience.
It's amazing, and we had another listener question from Keith Romano. He wanted to know about your preps for that episode. You mentioned a little bit about that, but did you study Sirik Lofton at all? Because you're playing the adult version of his character.
Yeah, I had met him before because I had been on his set before, but they sent me like 6 of his key episodes. I just wanted to get some of the physical. But we're both tall people, so you know that was easy, and just his way of speaking, and then a lot of imagination. But I know that he was really appreciative of how I continued his legacy, the what if.
I know actors have all kinds of different methods for bringing on the waterworks. That final scene with you and Avery Brooks, it's just unbelievable. How did you, what did you channel to bring on the tears?
Emotional memory and great training. Emotionalism has never been a distant stranger to me. I'm like a walking time bomb. That's why I spend so much time doing things that make me happy. You know, not that I grew up with a lot of pain in my life, not at all. I didn't even know we were poor until I was 14. My aunt always made sure there was a hot plate on the table and my clothes were clean and they were new. You know, having seen a lot of things in the world, I have a lot of emotional depth that is very, I don't want to use the word easy because it certainly doesn't come without a price, but I have no difficulty in drumming up whether it's racial memory or emotional memory or, you know, specific memory. And Avery has trained him. You know, Avery is a professor of theater, so it was like working with a giant. So you're only as good as your weakest link. You know, I've learned that over the years, and I've never been one to fight for cast approval or anything. But as I get older and older, it becomes more apparent that you're only as good as your weakest link. You cannot be a star without everybody being a star. So
yeah, you both fed off each other on that scene. It was so obvious. I mean, there was a lot of amazing acting going on there. Jason Kovalik is curious about, and again, you talking about the Star Trek universe, the sort of fan film Axanar. And again, we talk about fan films here on the show, and I know they're in between you doing that and today, there's been a lot has happened in the world of Paramount, Star Trek, fan films, all these different things. So whatever you're comfortable with, if you're not comfortable broaching the subject, that's fine. But he was curious as to why you left the project. And do you think that it's still worth fan support? And you're just maybe even your thoughts on fan films in general.
Well, I have no problem with fan films per se. I think that, you know, more and more I drive home from one place to another and I see, just 2 weeks ago, I saw an actor sitting on a fire hydrant and I'm saying, where's the crew? And then I saw a makeup woman getting out of her Beetle and they're supplying makeup. So that's where we've gotten. But again, I'm a SAG person. When I did Axanar, it was a SAG film. So,
okay.
You know, I'm happy with the short film that we did. I had some major issues with Alex Peters. And I couldn't, once he had done the crowd, and to this day, because of that experience, I won't participate in crowdfunding or Kickstarter. I don't believe in it. I didn't believe in it when it was first pitched to me. If you want to make a film, you need to raise the money yourself. Not ask fans to give up their portions of their weekly paycheck to do it. And once he had achieved his goals, and then he went back and tried to do another campaign, that's where I drew the line, and I had to leave. However, I know after when I left, he didn't disclose that for a good 4 or 5 months, and was using my image to solicit, and that doesn't sit well with me, and he knows how I feel.
Yeah, I actually saw it on the website for a while, yeah, even after you'd announced that, too. So, yeah, and I think that's what took that into the legal arena, too, which is unfortunate. Well, and again, one of the things Paramount's doing, Star Trek Discovery, new series on CBS All Access.
Yeah, did you see the trailer today?
I have not seen, as we're recording this, I have not seen the trailer yet.
Okay.
Good
yeah,
stuff?
The trailer just popped today.
You're happy with it?
Yeah, it's fine. You have two, well, I mean, you got two, the first officer is a woman and the captain's a woman. So they're making history.
Now, you'd mentioned last year about the possibility of showing up in Star Trek.
Also, you know, Seth MacFarlane also has a Star Trek.
That one I did see. That one I did see. That trick. Well, okay, could we see you in either one of these? Either the proper Star Trek Discovery or the Seth MacFarlane?
I know Seth is a huge Star Trek fan. Yeah. Both Michael and I have appeared on Family Guy.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually in talks for that, but a good friend of mine is doing the role, and so I wish them. I don't hate on anybody. I want the more things are successful, the more opportunity there is for actors to be a part of it. So
nothing official yet.
And I have no hate. And listen, going back to Axanar, when I did it, I loved doing it. They talked me into doing it. I loved they had a professional crew. I really, really connected with the director, Kristen Gossett, who doesn't get enough respect or appreciation for what he did. It was him that did that, not Alex.
So nothing nothing official yet on those. And Star Trek Discovery.
No, not yet.
You'd mentioned that you would want to be in it. I mean, you've been in like
At one point, I was on a short list. And
okay.
And they decided to not go with the familiar.
Okay. But there's a, yeah. but there is a, so, so but, nothing
but
official, but you're interested in it.
Of course. I'm interested in good stuff. I'm interested in being on Veep. They haven't asked me yet. I wanted to do The Sopranos. I wasn't Italian enough. Come on.
I think Tony Todd can do anything.
Work.
I think he can do
anything.
If you can be an alpha alpha hydrogen or alpha hydrogen?
Alpha Hirogen.
Alpha Hirogen. An alpha Hirogen. I knew I was going to
call me. What did you call me?
Alpha Hirogen.
An alpha what?
An alpha Hirogen. I knew I was going to screw that up. Oh, I'm a next gen Deep Space Nine kind of guy. Hey, okay. So again, one of our favorite thing. And I was standing right next to you when you did the voice, and I'm telling you what, I don't know. I'm guessing they tweaked it a titch digitally, but I can't imagine
they tweaked
it that much because you freaked me out, sir. You freaked
me
out.
Man. I mean, that came out of the total blue. We got a call in the middle of the week. It was a Wednesday, about 11 o'clock, saying, hey, you interested in being part of the DC universe? They didn't know who they were talking to. So they said, yeah, because I know in Hollywood you have to downplay things. I said, yeah. So they said, we'll let you know by 5. And so 4:30 came along, and they said, yeah, we want you to do it. And it was only supposed to be 4 episodes, and it ended up being, what, 14, 16?
Yeah,
and,
so how quick of a turnaround by the time you got the call till the time you're recording voiceover?
I was in the studio in 5 days. And then,
whoa.
But the first session, everybody was there. Okay. You know, the producers, and there's a guy who's specifically in charge of producing voiceover work. But everybody was there for the first session so that we could agree on where the voice lived. And once we did that, I hardly saw them again. And it was just wonderful. We were in a great studio in Burbank, which is the home of all the voiceover. You know, for all the fans that come to L.A. and do all the tourist stuff and go around to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, where you really want to go is Burbank. There's like a voiceover, you know, building every other block. And I've worked in a lot of them, and it's a great feeling. You walk in, you see, oh, wow, you know, this is where Scooby-Doo lived. This is where Flintstones lived. This is where the Jetsons lived, you know? And you're just laying down magic that affects not only a new audience for me, because now I'm getting 3-year-olds, 5-year-olds coming to my table, and I do Zoom on, where's the Flash? And their eyes just bug open, and, you know, it's an amazing feeling.
My eyes bugged open when you did it. You mentioned the phrase, you used the phrase, at that point we found out where the voice lived, finding where the voice lived. So how did you do that? What was that process?
We toyed it around. We had a set line, and we tried a couple of different takes. You know, my first, I wanted to do, where's the Flash? But they didn't like that.
Are you pulling my leg, or is that real?
I'm kind of pulling your
okay,
leg.
Okay, I was
just saying. We're just trying to find the voice.
That would have been a whole different show, man.
I need the Flash, and he needs to slow down.
It's like the trickster, man. Oh. Okay. I'm guessing because they cast Tony Todd, they wanted something Tony Todd-esque, right?
Yeah, but I have a pet peeve whenever they go and use a reference of something that I've already done. So, of course, Candyman came up, right? Okay. And I was resistant. I didn't want, you know, I have a lot of vocal range. And so we found something that fit. And, you know, and I just did another DC project that doesn't come out to 2018. I have a non-disclosure about it. But same thing happened with that. But this one is going to, by the way, debut at the New York Comic Con.
Can you say good guy or bad guy? Or is that too much? Is that giving away too much?
All characters are good guys. In their mind, Zoom is a good person. Okay.
I love that answer.
There's no villain. Does the Joker think he's bad?
No.
No.
Okay. This is all fair
enough. Quinn thinks she's a bad woman? No.
No. No, I totally get that. That's a great answer. When you're finding the voice for Zoom, did you have a picture? Because I know a lot of voiceover artists,
they
like to see a picture.
They gave me I had eyes only look at a secret laptop where they were just doing the initial designs, and they showed me some of the lightning flashes and the speedster element. And,
okay.
You know, so, and then subsequently, every time I came in, they would already have shot something so I could match the action, you know, to my little, my chair, my carafe of fresh squeezed ruby red grapefruit juice. Without the vodka, sir.
I was going to ask. I didn't know if there was an adult beverage involved or not to help you get to find the voice of Zoom. Now, had you been watching any of the series up to that point? Like, were you familiar with The Flash, or was that just not in your DVR at that point?
I hadn't, to be honest. I wasn't familiar with the actual TV series.
Okay.
But, of course, I read The Flash as a kid, Barry Allen, and who didn't, and Johnny Quick, even. But I certainly have been watching since then.
So that's in your DVR now. You watched the episodes, and you watched your episodes of Zoom out of it?
Yeah, because it was getting a lot of pop culture attention.
Okay.
And it was like,
well, Teddy Sears, I interviewed him, and he said he didn't watch any. He can't watch himself.
Yeah. Well, every actor is different. I usually don't watch my movies unless... Mm. I have a new person in my life, and I want them to get some sort of sense of who I am besides a couch sitter. But Zoom is different because it's a voice, so it's not, you know what I mean? So that's easier to watch. But no, I don't. No.
Okay. And so you've seen it now since then?
Most actors are uncomfortable. Yeah, I haven't watched much of this current season because Zoom is somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I've heard good things.
Well, he's a CGI character now. He's Black Flash. So I didn't know if...
Right.
I know it's kind of like growls and stuff now, but have they ever talked about bringing you back maybe as Black Flash?
Well, I knew Black Flash was going to happen. I think they wanted a different voice at that point, but they did tell me on my last session that I am forever a part of the DC Universe.
Nice. Okay, so there could be...
But I also read something just last week saying that there will not be a speedster in next season.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, maybe the year after that.
Okay, but there's a lot of characters in the Arrowverse. There's a lot of shows in the Arrowverse, even more coming up.
You know,
we've mentioned them. Would you like to be a live-action character in one of these series?
They just picked up Black Lightning.
Yep.
Which is Greg Berlanti again. And the actor who's playing it, Cress Williams, we worked together on a movie years ago called Dog Walker. So, yeah, I'm into pop culture. So, but I don't sit here with a big dartboard, you know, throwing things, saying this is what I want. Da-da-da.
But you have Berlanti on speed dial, right?
Somebody does.
The aforementioned manager.
Okay, the truth's out. I want to be on Riverdale, okay?
I don't blame you. I talked to Mark Hamill. He says he loves the show. We're obsessed with it. I can't stop watching it. It's a great show. Would you appear on Riverdale? That'd be very cool.
I'm a working actor, so I listen to everything.
I want to see you.
And I also know Greg Berlanti. All of his shows shoots up in Vancouver. So Vancouver, if you've never been there, get up there. Aside from being Hollywood North, their food is incredible. It's a port city. You know, it's just a different way of, and you get away from the politics of America.
I think we're going to see you in the Berlanti universe in live action here pretty soon.
I'm pretty sure.
I know we're going to see you on the stage. You just wrapped up recently Sunset Baby in Connecticut, right? You head back to Connecticut and walked the boards there, right?
They invited me back. I was there, began the year doing a strong piece of work.
Nice.
Wonderful.
More theater coming up?
Not in the foreseeable future, but I'd never go a year without. That's not true. Before Sunset Baby, I was doing a play called Ghost in the House, which is about Jack Johnson, the first heavyweight champion in America circa 1900s. And we did it about, I don't know, a total of 12 performances or so. But now the director is talking about filming it. But it'll be filmed as a stage piece.
Nice.
So he's talking about that. He just lost his theater, however, the working stage theater, folks. Every theater that we lose is a brick taking out of the wall of culture. So before you build that parking lot, as Joni Mitchell once said, know what you're doing.
How do we, are there any places people can go to just sort of find out more about that or how they can save their local theaters maybe?
I know Frank's theater, working stage, Frank Megna. He's on Facebook. He's very political. He's searching for a new home right now,
okay.
Theater-wise. You know, and then, of course, my Twitter feed, at TonyTodd54. I'm pretty present.
You are there, that's for sure. And we're going to find out about your upcoming conventions there, too. You'll tweet those out. You've got
yes,
a few coming up
absolutely.
Here over the summer, right? You're going to be,
right.
Speaking of Canada, you're going to be in Montreal. You've got dates, what, in June and July?
Montreal, which I love. Montreal is the beginning of July. And then Raleigh, North Carolina in mid-July. And in July is Florida SuperCon.
Man, you're going to be all over. Fans can, I'm telling you what, have them do Zoom, the voice in your ear. It's worth the price of admission, man.
Right.
It is so cool. Man, Tony, I had a fantastic time meeting up with you in Connecticut. Hope to get to see you again sometime soon.
It was great, man. And I've had a pleasant time talking to you. And I'm glad we can finally make this happen, okay?
I thank you for taking the time to chat with us today on Comic Book Central.
Love to you and your family and your fan base there.
Same to you and yours. I appreciate it.
Peace.
Make sure you follow Tony on Twitter. Everything that's going on, he's going to be posting there. I'm going to put a link to his Twitter feed in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. Hey, follow Tony on Twitter. You will be in the know about all the places he plans to go. If you do get a chance to meet up with him, man, I'm telling you, do it. He is an incredibly nice man. So the opposite of so many of the characters he plays. He is a true comic book fanboy, as you've just heard. So that's cool. Man, ain't it awesome when they love the same things that we love? I always love that, right? If you do meet up with Tony Todd, be sure to tell him Stuberman from Comic Book Central sent you. My thanks again to Tony for sitting down with us to chat today about all these amazing characters, all these amazing projects. Man, that was fun. Hey, time to check out the Comic Book Central mailbag. This week, I heard from listener Paul Monroe, who writes, "Hey, Joe, wanted to quickly say that I just discovered Comic Book Central and listened through all of your Lost in Space-themed interviews. Loved them. We were at the big show in Secaucus, New Jersey, where they reunited a few weekends ago. The Lost in Space cast are beautiful. Thanks for doing what you're doing." Hey, thanks for doing what you're doing, Paul. Listening to the show and writing in. I always appreciate that. Don't forget to share the Lair on social media. I always mention that. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you subscribe to the show and iTunes as well if you haven't already done that. That always helps out. A lot of great episodes out there waiting for you. I had a blast putting together those Lost in Space theme shows. Glad you enjoyed them. Yeah, there were a bunch of them. So if you're new to the show, if you're new to Comic Book Central, those are out there. And I am so glad you got to meet up with the cast at the show in Secaucus, New Jersey. Man, yeah, it looks like I saw some Facebook pictures there. It looks like they had a blast at the show themselves. Sorry I missed it. That would have been a very cool one, but hopefully get to see them at some point in the future. Who knows? Maybe at Trificon or one of these shows I attended one of these days. That would be very cool to get to be able to meet them in person. Hey, if you'd like to drop me a line, it's joe@comicbookcentral.net, or you can click the Signal Me tab on the website, comicbookcentral.net, or you can even record a voicemail message at the website. I'd love to hear from you. All right, folks, time for me to channel the Speed Force and head on out of here. But fear not, I will be speeding right back here into the lair before you know it, because next week on Comic Book Central, Guy Gardner, Zeta, Kraven the Hunter, Booster Gold, and, of course, Batman. They will all be here because the man who voices all of those animated characters and many more, he's going to be sitting down for a chat from Batman Brave and the Bold and so many other cool cartoons. Diedrich Bader, he is going to be stopping by. I know you will be here as well. Until then, remember, don't serve a Klingon caviar. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders. Comic Book Central live again from Trificon. Look who showed up.
Wait a minute. What is this? Is this Facebook Live?
This is your first one,
too. Oh, my God. It's my first time.
Man, Zoom?
Zoom.
The voice. Give us a little bit of Zoom.
I am the fastest man alive.
Okay, that actually did just give me chills right there.